I'm Luther Littke, and we're meeting this afternoon to discuss the American author Flannery O'Connor, particularly her short story, Good Country People, which was written and immediately published in 1955. Flannery O'Connor is not only one of the major figures of American prose writing, both in novels and short stories, since World War II, but as importantly for our purposes, she's a person with a particularly penetrating insight into the spiritual condition of the modern world, who brought to her works an orthodoxy and a candid set of religious convictions that are unique, in my experience anyhow, among contemporary American writers. A couple of you may have been at the session which we held last week on Nathaniel Hawthorne's short story, Young Goodman Brown, and there is a tradition in American literature, often called the dark tradition, which extends at least from the time of Nathaniel Hawthorne in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s to Flannery O'Connor and beyond in the 20th century. She continues the kind of problematic wrestling with God that Hawthorne was very much engaged in. During the time that we have here, which is going to be described by a 60-minute tape which is made of this session, I would like for us to emphasize discussion and discussion of the story itself. But for future users of the tape recording, as well as for some of you who may not have had an opportunity to read the story, or whose minds might not be particularly fresh, I think we should start with a brief synopsis of Flannery O'Connor's life. I will describe her biography, and then also summarize some of the main elements of the story to outline it very, very briefly again. Flannery O'Connor was born in 1925 in Savannah, Georgia, the only child of Edward Francis O'Connor and Regina Klein O'Connor. And the family moved from Savannah, Georgia to the small community of Milledgeville, Georgia, when Flannery O'Connor was 12 years old. At that time, her father had been stricken with a disease called something like lupus erythematosus, which is a peculiarly literary disease in one way, in as much as it's a metabolic disorder by which the body digests its own protein. And at the time that her father was struck with it, there were no chemical cures, and he did die of it when Flannery O'Connor was 15 years old. She enrolled at Georgia State College for Women, which is now called Georgia College, in her hometown of Milledgeville, and graduated from there with a Bachelor of Arts degree in 1945. At this time, she had already moved in the direction of writing, experimenting with works for student publications at her college, and was granted a fellowship to the very prestigious Writers' Workshop at the University of Iowa, where she enrolled in 1945. Other contemporary American writers who have gone through the Writers' Workshop include Kurt Vonnegut, for example, and a professor at Brown University where I did my work, whose name I can't remember right now, but in that unpromising part of the country, there is this intensive think tank for creative writers, which has produced some of the best people working still today. Flannery O'Connor later admitted that when she went to the University of Iowa to begin studying, she hadn't heard of William Faulkner, much less read him at the time, and thought that she was particularly shallow and undeveloped. But in her 2 years at the University of Iowa, she went through an intensive training or period of reading all of the best contemporary American and European writers, at least those who weren't on the Catholic Index, which she very carefully abided by at that time, asking dispensations later to read André Gide's works. She published her first story while she was at the Writers' Workshop. This was in 1946, and completed her Master of Fine Arts degree there in 1947, where she won the annual Reinhardt Award for the best work in progress. She began writing the novel Wise Blood while she was a student at Iowa, published some chapters of it in magazines in the late 40s, and was given this award of $750 for her accomplishments there. It also gave the Reinhardt Publishing Company the option to publish the novel itself when it was finally completed. Very quickly after leaving Iowa, she received a fellowship at the Yaddo Artist Colony in Saratoga, New York, which at that time I think had in residence Robert Lowell, also in two or three other people of a major stature. And already at 23 years old, she was identified as a real comer. She was at Yaddo for a time. After some upheaval there, left, went to New York City, spent a couple of not too satisfactory months working in New York, and then moved to Ridgefield, Connecticut, where she lived with Sally and Robert Fitzgerald for some time over a year, continuing to work on Wise Blood. She's an excruciatingly slow writer, at least in the novel form. It was easy for her to dash off short stories, but novels seemed to take her a great amount of time. The particular kind of farcical and visionary style that she has lends itself to the shorter scope of short stories, but to put together the larger cast of characters and the larger dramatic setting of a novel is difficult for her. She finally published Wise Blood in 1952, after she'd been at work on it for over 5 years. It was about 1948 that Flannery O'Connor returned to her hometown of Milledgeville, Georgia, under duress. She was discovered at that time to have herself a metabolic disorder, which was later diagnosed as the same disease which had killed her father, that of lupus. And much weakened, she returned to her mother's farm of Andalusia outside Milledgeville. Her letters show her to be a particularly unself-pitying person. She returned without resistance and apparently without regret, and later said that her forced return to Georgia was the primary condition for her continuing to be a writer. She needed to return to the native soil, to the speech rhythms, to the rather Baroque life patterns of the area in which she had grown up. She was treated with massive doses of cortisone and various other experimental drugs which had been developed since the time of her father's death, and achieved some stability, although she was physically weak for the rest of her life. She would write for 2 or 3 hours in the morning and take the afternoon off and be in bed by 9 o'clock at night to store up her energy again. She set up farming with her mother. Her letters are full of tales of her mother's building water tanks and buying 3/4-ton pickup trucks and wrestling particularly with the farm help problem. There would be one set of white tenant farmers or hired helpers after another moving on and off the place, each one worse than the set before. And her mother, Regina O'Connor, also specialized in picking up displaced persons. First of all, refugees from the Second World War, and later Hungarian refugees also. And in one wry comment on the Hungarians, Flannery O'Connor says she was becoming more and more sympathetic with the Russians all the time in struggling with these intractable and impossible people. Some of her comments also on the black farm help seem also to smack of Southern bigotry, although she was at least theoretically an integrationist. Flannery O'Connor set out to raise peacocks herself, and she surrounded herself with fowls of different kinds, Muscovy ducks and Canadian geese and different kinds of geese, and particularly peacocks, having at one time as many as 30 peacocks on her farm. And the peacock has sometimes been used as a symbol, really, for Flannery O'Connor's attitude to life, a bird that is almost impossibly and artificially beautiful, and yet which is violent and savage and cannibalistic. When one of her peacocks lost a leg to some farm implement, for example, she had to partition it off from the rest of the peacocks, lest they devour it. That combination of savagery and almost transcendental beauty is somewhat characteristic of her works. She continued to write very ably in Georgia, and in 1960 published a collection of short stories, A Good Man is Hard to Find, which is found in this volume. Becoming increasingly recognized throughout the country, receiving a number of different awards, being sought out by some of the most talented of American writers. She was a particular friend of Mrs. Allen Tate. Allen Tate himself, a major 20th century American poet who went through a conversion to Catholicism at the midpoint in his career. John Crow Ransom, who was a major poet and also a very religious person. And other less religious people, such as John Hawkes. And her letters show her to be increasingly involved in the world, making trips so far as her health would allow to give public addresses at Michigan and Iowa such places as that. She only made one trip overseas. In 1958, a wealthy aunt from Savannah sent her and her mother to the baths at, how's it pronounced, Lourdes, L-O-U-R-D-E-S. And much against her better judgment, she actually sat in the bath, not because she believed that there would be any healing which would come from it, but to gratify her aunt, who was footing the bill for the trip. Beginning in 1955, she was confined to crutches. She thought at first, or the doctors told her, that a deteriorating hip condition was due not to her basic metabolic disease, but instead to arthritis. She believed this for a time, and later that too was linked to her primary disease, but very cheerfully, and she always refers ironically to her tin legs in her letters also. A Good Man is Hard to Find, her collection of short stories was published in 1955, and in 1960, The Violent Bear It Away, her second novel, was published, which is also collected in three by Flannery O'Connor. From 1960 to 1965, Flannery O'Connor continued to write short stories. She was struck, I think it was with a kidney condition in the mid-1960s, which necessitated an operation. The operation itself was successful, and the organ which was removed was found to be non-malignant, but the stress of the operation reactivated the metabolic problem of lupus, and it became apparent that she was dying, despite what miracles modern chemistry might work for her. But with a truly heroic effort on her part, she did complete the set of stories which went into Everything That Rises Must Converge, published posthumously in 1965. In 1979, Flannery O'Connor's letters have been published. I have the book here and have distributed around excerpts from these letters. They've been collected and edited by her friend Sally Fitzgerald, and they had the honor of being identified in Time magazine last spring as one of the 10 most significant religious publications of the 1970s. In a small squib, Time magazine pointed out that there are 15,000 religious books published in the United States during the decade of the 1970s, and 10 of those perhaps have some chance of really enduring importance. One was Sidney Alstrom's Religious History of the American People. There's a book by Yaroslav Pelikan, a book by Kristen Stendahl, one of Martin Marty's works, Flannery O'Connor's Letters. And that is a mighty, mighty distinction. And in many ways, her letters are, I think, are really the most satisfying of her work. Terribly funny, terribly candid, no trace of self-pity or reluctance at all in them, and really quite theological as she carries out correspondence with the priesthood, with the hierarchy of her church, and with also creative writers throughout the country. Some of the best statements on the limits and freedoms and obligations of a literary artist working within a Christian tradition exist in this book. And I very much encourage it if you're reading. This is a library copy, which I've been marking up, but when I go home, I'm going to get my own copy and transfer all the notes that I've been making in light pencil in the margins here into the other copy. Flannery O'Connor was a problem to literary critics at the time that she emerged. Many identified her as a hillbilly writer, and others dismissed her as simply obscene. The Catholic press had a great struggle in trying to place her, trying to identify her. The label which has probably stuck best to her is the Southern Gothic writer, in a tradition which also includes figures like William Faulkner, particularly, Styron for another, who were some, yes, right, I was trying to think of Carson McCullers as another writer also. The Southern setting, the regional location for Flannery O'Connor is deeply important, and her works are filled with the peculiar colorations of a part of the country which is fundamentalist, which is Protestant, which has a history of violence. Violence is a practical fact of Southern life, and also with the comedy and the irony peculiar to that part of the country. Let me ask how many of you have, or whether anyone here has not read Good Country People. Okay, even for the sake of the two of you, I think as well as whoever may someday listen to the tape, I might very quickly outline the story of what happens. I've selected Good Country People because, well, for several reasons. First of all, because it's an index of Flannery O'Connor's larger concern. I think most of the elements of the life of her writing exist here. And the central character, Joy Hoga Hopewell, and what goes through her life and what happens to her reappears in other characters in other places as well. But secondarily, because of the great joy and enthusiasm which Flannery O'Connor showed for this story herself, she had collected 12 stories which were sent off to Harcourt Brace, her publisher, to be published as A Good Man is Hard to Find. And in 1 week, she sat down, unconnected with that, and the story Good Country People came to her. She wrote it in 4 days, which is very, very fast for Flannery O'Connor's writing. And she wrote to Harcourt Brace and said, "Stop presses. This is the best that I've done yet. I've never written a story that I've enjoyed more. This has to go in. Can you make room for it?" She suggested which other stories should be thrown out of the collection to make room for this one. The other story in this collection, which she most respected, is Artificial Migger. And she thought that short story probably represented the working of grace better than any of her other tales. And she labored over that story for a good month before she thought she finally had it right. Kind of indicated her attitude towards her own stories. Incidentally, immediately after the publication of Flannery O'Connor's collection, A Good Man is Hard to Find, she got lots of marriage proposals from people around West Virginia and Carolina who said, "Well, in effect, a good man really isn't so hard to find. I'm 31 years old, 6 feet 2 inches, fairly strong, a pretty intelligent guy, and I've got a good income. Are you interested? Send details about yourself." They hadn't read her stories, of course, but they thought the title of her collection was a plea for matrimony. Worse than anything but, of course. Good Country People is set, as almost all of Flannery O'Connor's stories are, on a farmstead in the rural South in the present day, probably Georgia, but that kind of countryside anyhow. More particularly, in the kitchen of the house of the farmstead and on the rolling fields of the farm and the hayloft of one of the outlying farm buildings. The cast of characters include Mrs. Hopewell, the owner of the farm, and her daughter, Joy Hoga, who is 32 years old, unmarried, and a somewhat slouchy and embittered person that we'll hear more about afterwards. There is a second set of characters also who appear immediately, and they are the wife and two daughters of the farm help, Mrs. Freeman and her daughters, Glynis and Kara May. The Freemans serve function in the short story as foils to Mrs. Hopewell and also to Joy Hoga. There's a contrast operating between the two. Into this chicken coop or dovecote, halfway through the story, comes a serpentine young Bible salesman named Manly Pointer. We could talk about the imagery of his name a little bit later, perhaps. I'd like to read the opening couple paragraphs of this story, not only as a characterization of these five women. Mrs. Hopewell divorced her husband at some point earlier, and like Mrs. O'Connor, was herself running the farm, but also to try to express the tone of voice that Flannery O'Connor uses in her writing. She's a master of dialogue. Her letters are particularly funny also, as they alternate between her southern hillbilly dialect, which she shares with friends on the one hand, and a very formal and kind of objective English language, which she uses in corresponding with the literati and the literary critics that she was communicating with. The story begins. "Besides the neutral expression that she wore when she was alone, Mrs. Freeman had two others, forward and reverse, that she used for all her human dealings. Her forward expression was steady and driving like the advance of a heavy truck. Her eyes never swerved to left or right, but turned as the story turned, as if they followed a yellow line down the center of it. She seldom used the other expression because it was not often necessary for her to retract a statement. But when she did, her face came to a complete stop. There was an almost imperceptible movement of her black eyes, during which they seemed to be receding, and then the observer would see that Mrs. Freeman, though she might stand there as real as several grain sacks thrown on top of each other, was no longer there in spirit. As for getting anything across to her when this was the case,
Mrs. Hopewell had given it up. She might talk her head off. Mrs. Freeman could never be brought to admit herself wrong on any point. She would stand there, and if she could be brought to say anything, it was something like, "Well, I wouldn't have said it was, and I wouldn't have said it wasn't." Or letting her gaze range over the top kitchen shelf where there was an assortment of dusty bottles, she might remark, "I see you ain't ate many of them figs you put up last summer." They carried on their most important business in the kitchen, breakfast. Every morning, Mrs. Hopewell got up at 7 o'clock and lit her gas heater in Joy's. Joy was her daughter, a large blonde girl who had an artificial leg. Mrs. Hopewell thought of her as a child, though she was 32 years old and highly educated. Joy would get up while her mother was eating and lumber into the bathroom and slam the door. And before long, Mrs. Freeman would arrive at the back door. Joy would hear her mother call, "Come on in." And then they would talk for a while in low voices that were indistinguishable in the bathroom. By the time Joy came in, they had usually finished the weather report and were on one or the other of Mrs. Freeman's daughters, Glynis or Caramay. Joy called them Glycerin and Caramel. Glynis, a redhead, was 18 and had many admirers. Caramay, a blonde, was only 15, but already married and pregnant. She could not keep anything on her stomach. Every morning, Mrs. Freeman told Mrs. Hopewell how many times she had vomited since the last report. I realize, even in reading this, how impossible it is to try to recreate the characterization that Flannery O'Connor does throughout an entire story and with her own language. She really is a master of Southern dialogue. A passage at the bottom of page 244 and top page 245, if you have the book here, is one that I would read to you. When Mrs. Hopewell said to Mrs. Freeman that life was like that, Mrs. Freeman would say, "I always said so myself." Nothing had been arrived at by anyone that had not first been arrived at by her. She was quicker than Mr. Freeman. When Mrs. Hopewell said to her after they'd been on the place a while, "You know, when you're the wheel behind the, you know, you're the wheel behind the wheel," and winked, Mrs. Freeman had said, "I know it. I've always been quick. Yet some that are quicker than others." "Everybody is different," Mrs. Hopewell said. "Yes, most people is," Mrs. Freeman said. "It takes all kinds to make the world. I always said it did myself." The girl was used to this kind of dialogue for breakfast and more of it for dinner. Sometimes they had it for supper, too. One thing you notice in reading this story is the very trite veneer of language which overlays it all, the most thoughtless, banty, back and forth, and mindless kinds of social conversation. I think when reading that, you have to ask immediately, what is peculiarly religious about this, if you've been told that she's a religious writer? And that's one of the questions that we can take up afterwards also. The central character soon emerges as the daughter, Joy Hopewell, who at age 10 lost her leg. We don't find out quite how much until late in the story, in a hunting accident. Her leg was blown away, and without passing out even, she observed her lost limb. And this has kept her from having any normal kind of happiness, as her mother says. When Joy Holga turns 21, or when Joy turns 21, without telling her mother, she goes off to the county seat and changes her name. Changes her name from Joy to Holga. And does so, her mother believes, in order to vex her mother and to create as much ugliness as she possibly can. There's one passage that I would read to you in this regard on page 246. She considered the name her personal affair. She arrived at it first purely on the basis of its ugly sound, and then the full genius of its fitness had struck her. She had a vision of the name working like the ugly, sweating falcon who stayed in the furnace and to whom, presumably, the goddess had to come when called. She saw it as the name of her highest creative act. One of her major triumphs was that her mother had not been able to turn her dust into Joy, but the greater one was that she had been able to turn it herself into Holga. She's gone off in the interim, gotten a PhD in philosophy to her mother's chagrin, and come home to continue to read philosophy. About two-thirds of the way through the story, maybe a little bit less, a traveling Bible salesman comes to the door and ingratiates himself with the mother, who immediately believes that he, like Mrs. Freeman and her daughter, is good country people. And he certainly leads her to this belief also. He gets himself invited to dinner. Joy Holga avoids him at the dinner table, refuses to answer as many questions, but surprisingly is found by Mrs. Freeman and Mrs. Hopewell
talking to him further down the lane as he's leaving for the night. And we learn that he has invited her, she has invited him to a picnic, an arrangement which is made the next day. Her motives are most curious. And during that night before the picnic, Joy Holga imagines that she had seduced him. She imagines that the two of them walked on the place until they came to the storage barn behind the two back fields, and there she imagined that things came to such a pass that she very easily seduced him, and that then, of course, she had to reckon with his remorse. True genius can get an idea across, even to an inferior soul. She imagined that she took his remorse in hand and changed it into a deeper understanding of life. She took all his shame away and turned it into something useful. When they link up the next morning, he's still carrying his valise of Bibles, although now it seems to swing much lighter and more easily than the night before. And although she asks him to leave the valise behind, he says, well, you never can tell when you'll need a Bible. She tries to stun him by telling him that she doesn't believe in God. And this is going to be the first step in her process of diabolically breaking down his simple-minded Southern Protestant Sunday school level faith, but it only seems to pique his curiosity in her. Finally, he boldly puts his hand on her back and begins to kiss her, and very coldly she analyzes her lack of response to the kisses. And after they've kissed for a time, they find their way into the barn, up into the haymow. She is trying to attract him into the haymow and is amazed at the ease with which it is done. And he removes her glasses, puts them in her pocket, in his pocket, stripping her of that means of vision. Glasses, eyeglasses, are very important in Flannery O'Connor's writings, particularly Wise Blood, which has been made into a film that we might talk about afterwards. And then begins to force her to confess that she loves him as he loves her. And of course, she wobbles on this, and she doesn't want to use such a trite, cheap, sentimental term as love, and begins to say, well, in a sense, I suppose, but it's illusory, and so forth. And he finally asks her, does she love him or not, yes or no? And her response is, okay then. No, wait a minute. She says, yes. Okay then, he said, letting her go, prove it. Really smacks of the 1950s. I don't know whether teenagers talk that way anymore. She smiled, looking dreamily out on the shifty landscape. She had seduced him without even making up her mind to try. How? She asked, feeling that he should be delayed a mite. He leaned over and put his lips to her ear. Show me where your wooden leg joins on, he whispered. The girl uttered a sharp little cry, and her face instantly drained of color. The obscenity of the suggestion was not what shocked her. As a child, she had sometimes been subject to feelings of shame, but education had removed the last traces of that, as a good surgeon scrapes for cancer. She would no more have felt it over what he was asking than she would have believed in his Bible. But she was as sensitive about the artificial leg as a peacock about his tail. No one ever touched it but her. She took care of it as someone else would his soul, in private, and almost with her own eyes turned away. No, she said. I know it, he muttered, sitting up. You're just playing me for a sucker. Oh, no, no, she cried. It joins on at the knee, only at the knee. Why do you want to see it? The boy gave her a long, penetrating look. Because, he said, it's what makes you different. You ain't like anyone else. She sat staring at him. There was nothing about her face or her round, freezing blue eyes to indicate that this had moved her, but she felt as if her heart had stopped and left her mind to pump her blood. She decided that for the first time in her life she was face to face with real innocence. This boy, with an instinct that came from beyond wisdom, had touched the truth about her. When after a minute she said in a hoarse, high voice, all right, it was like surrendering to him completely. It was like losing her own life and finding it again miraculously in his. And after they have removed the leg, she really begins to feel quite passionate and motherly towards her. But when she asks to have it put on again, he moves it further and further away, and then suggests to her that they have some real fun, and opens his suitcase. Wait, he said. He leaned the other way and pulled the valise toward him and opened it. It had a pale blue spotted lining, and there were only two Bibles in it. He took one of these out and opened the cover of it. It was hollow, and contained a pocket flask of whiskey, a pack of cards, and a small blue box with printing on it. He laid these out in front of her, one at a time, in an evenly shaped, spaced row, like one presenting offerings at the shrine of a goddess. He put the blue box in her hand, and in bold-faced letters, "This product to be used only for the prevention of disease," she read, and dropped it. Incidentally, sometimes my students do not know what that is. He stopped and pointed with a smile to the deck of cards. It was not an ordinary deck, but one with an obscene picture on the back of each card. "Take a swig," he said, offering her the bottle first. He held it in front of her, but like one mesmerized, she did not move. Her voice, when she spoke, had an almost pleading sound. "Aren't you," she murmured, "aren't you just good country people?" And Manly Pointer's response to this is a very sardonic one, concluding with this statement: "You ain't so smart. I've been believing in nothing ever since I was born." There are several ironies in this, which I shouldn't begin to interpret, but in the last several paragraphs here, which I won't read, Joy Holga beseeches him to return her leg. He throws it into the valise where it lands between the two Bibles, like a book between a pair of bookends. The case gets slammed shut. He tells her of the number of other women that he has seduced in this way, why he's even gotten a glass eye once, and he carries the trophy off down the ladder from the barn across the hills, and the story ends with Mrs. Hopewell and Mrs. Freeman seeing him crossing the fields and contemplating that he's probably managed to sell some Bible to the niggers, as I think they call them here, and one of the ladies saying, "I could never be so innocent." Well, that's the story. What was your response to it, or what did you make of the story when you read it? I would have preferred, actually, that we'd all read the story with no inkling that Flannery O'Connor had a religious sentiment in her head, as that is the kind of reading that she would have gotten, at least initially, from her contemporaries, who would have known nothing about her biography or where she was coming from. But what were your responses to this story? Outrage, amusement, repulsion? I think it's difficult for us, and I've had very little contact with the South, to separate out what may be a nearly literal picture of what people would say or do in that part of the country from what is exaggeration or farce or fantasy. Finally, it may not make all that much difference how much of it is reality or not. There are some powerful schools of regional writing in this country, and I think the most fruitful way to approach 20th century American writing is either through region or through ethnicity. And the Southern writers themselves carry a legacy of defeat and guilt from the institution of slavery in the Second World War, or the Civil War, and so forth. And one of the other major regional movements is the New York Jewish school of writing, and there's also a Californian school of writing emerging, and there's a Midwestern school and so forth too. And beginning with the land that they know best and setting their taproots down into that, they all come finally to the same kind of, not to the same, but they tend to move towards the universal, out of the particular, towards the universal. And at the end here, we should be working towards some universal truths or observations also which can come out of the story. What particularly revulsed you about the story? Let's just take those two terms of revulsion and comedy and try to identify how the story brought about that feeling in you.
I found in it the same kind of feeling I've had with reading some other Southern writers, though, and that's sort of not a colorless, but a poverty feeling that you get, that we poor folk, or we poor in spirit or something, but it seems to pervade, that it's always sort of grim, and there's a lot of small talk, but nothing ever significant said, and there's always somebody terribly brilliant who is misunderstood.
Mm-hmm. Well, what might be the function of all the small talk and the lack of incident in Flannery O'Connor's writing? As indicated by that passage of dialogue that I read, for example, there's absolutely no substance in it. Mm-hmm. It's just to fill the air with noise and to send out kind of signals of understanding or neighborliness between people. What's the worth of writing at all if that's all you have to say or put into a story?
Well, Well, mirrors what we do. How we get through everyday life.
Right. That's true.
Well, it establishes those characters. I mean, that's the way they carry on their conversation. So then you have a certain picture of what they're like, which you wouldn't have if you didn't include that.
That's a very good point. And in her letters, also, Flannery O'Connor instructs other writers to emphasize characterization first, not to begin to write with an idea. And she claimed that she never began to write with an idea or even a sense of where she was going in a story, but that a character would come to her and she would try to work up the character as best as she could, believing in the importance of any human being in any place. And she would let them live their life and then discover a message within it and let the message happen. Such as it is. You might say that she's really administering to the least of these in her writings, avoiding conspicuously important characters.
There's also a way in which that dialogue becomes a contrast, though, for something deeper, that these poor country people, all of a sudden it's like an epiphany is the only word I can think of, though. I don't think it has to be a liturgical word. Where something is opened up, a depth of emotion, or even like the parables do, turn things around. What was first becomes last, and the person who thought she was seducing the other one ends up being seduced. And so I think that kind of mundane language ends up being a contrast for the depth of emotion and experience that's underneath that surface.
That's a very good point. Betty made the mistake of reading A Good Man Is Hard to Find instead of Good Country People at first. And I don't know whether any of you have read that story or not, but it illustrates beautifully, I think, the point that you've just made also. The Flannery O'Connor starts with people walking along the surface, kind of membrane of reality, the sort of world in which we live in 99-95% of the time. And then it's as if they step into an abyss, as if terra firma is pulled out from underneath them, and they're plunged instantly into a kind of hell of reality, into a confrontation with something which hasn't entered their consciousness but is rampant in the world. And out of that fall, perhaps, can also come transcendence, can come an ascent, that out of the destruction can also come the recognition of one's own, the ephemeral nature of life and the incompleteness of the human being by themselves. So that perhaps, in one of the passages or one of the selections that I passed around from her letters, also Flannery O'Connor raises a question whether faith is consolatory, and whether most people are not led to religious conviction as a result of some handicap or accidents or deprivation. And she claims that it is not necessary, but indeed that redemption sometimes works that way. And that it's in that hour of peril that grace comes. Which is to put religiously what you said dramatically also, that it lends the contrast between the ordinary and the supernatural in her works, that we have such mundane, to use your words, such mundane characters in life. What is funny in Flannery O'Connor's writing? I think she is side-splittingly and screamingly funny if you put yourself in the right mood for reading her.
I think Mrs. Freeman was funny in this particular one, but I wanted to take that point of what you were discussing just one step further. She leaves you without grace at the end. I mean, does she do this with all of her story? I mean, she leaves this girl distraught, or, you know, she leaves the satanic figure running off with the goods, which he apparently has done before, and leaves in a state of desolation. Now, that's the other thing I think that I see, the desolation feeling that you end up with. Does she do this in other stories that she's written, and The Good Man Is Hard to Find?
Well, that's true. It's true that Good Country People does not demonstrate the full story of Flannery O'Connor's writings as well as some of the others do, like the novel Wise Blood also. She identifies herself or compares herself with Joy Holga in another statement for that she
for just a moment.
And her opinion wasn't solicited on this, but she wrote to some correspondent, "My heroine already is, and is Holga. Holga, in this case, would be a projection of myself into this kind of tragic comic action, presumably only a projection, because if I could not stop short of it myself, I could not write it." And then, in a kind of illumination, she continues, "Stop short of it, or go beyond it."
I should say. Yeah.
I think what Flannery O'Connor is saying, to paraphrase bluntly in this case, is that perhaps she could imagine herself being duped as Joy Holga was, but that if she had been, she would not have stopped at that point, but that for her would have come an illumination through it. It's just cut off. We don't know what happens to Joy Holga after this point. That would be another story. What do you think might happen to Joy Holga?
I would be interested in knowing how many people here thought the ending was really funny or felt desolated like you did. Like, I thought it was really funny. I didn't leave the story feeling empty or desolated.
What was funny about it?
I guess just that the very opposite happened. It was just so unexpected and just such a weird thing to happen to a person.
Mm-hmm.
And especially to somebody who, it seemed, was so very much in control of herself and above everybody else.
Did you sense that Manly Pointer might be a different kind of a guy before Joy Holga herself found out what he was?
I sort of had my suspicions.
He does become more manipulative of her, and we see that working out. Flannery O'Connor also gives us some extra clues when she describes his eyes like two steel spikes also driving into her, and that certainly is not a soft Sunday school kind of mentality. And he's obviously working her. There are some sexual puns also that emerge at that point. The name Manly Pointer is a really very phallic image. And ironically, whereas we expect that she's going to get screwed, to use the jargon of the day, she gets unscrewed. Also, the leg is taken off. And the word screw is used at a number of places in the last pages, the screwing of the flask on and off the cap of the whiskey flask. And what is taken from her is something more important than her virginity, also.
Right.
His designs on her are more diabolic than just the sexual.
He takes her soul instead of her body.
What's so important about the leg, though, about this artificial leg?
She's invested all of her inability to do anything in that.
And you can, I could draw a parallel between a PhD in philosophy, which is, she spent her life, part of her life doing that. And the, you know, I don't know if you could make it that simple of a symbolism, but maybe she's ready for grace now that she's not.
He also says that that's what makes you different. And she responds to that right away, as if somehow, here's a man, simple though he seems to be, understands something that she understands real well, that this leg has set her apart and the pain of it and what she's had to overcome. I mean, I get the sense that that's where she's duped, is when he says, this was what makes you different than anyone else. And it's that wonderful feeling of finally being known by another that makes her vulnerable. But then the irony comes when he's not interested in the pain or the person or the process of having to get through this artificial leg, but just the leg itself, you know. I guess that's where I think there is grace in it, is something has touched her enough to risk with another, to be open up herself to another person, mm-hmm. and the same thing happens that always happens as she gets hurt. That's mm-hmm. always what happens. Mm-hmm. So I saw that as a grace-filled moment, and then the humor of it kind of made it even better.
I guess I didn't feel it was completed.
She'll have to work it out.
Yeah, she's going to have to work it out. Well, she's going to work it out with her mother's going to be very
That's a very good point, though. It's the first time that she becomes, that she starts to open herself up and does become vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And the language and the sensibility of her also change at that time. And she has tried to protect herself against feeling. Flannery O'Connor's characters are psychologically believable at the same time that they sometimes carry a lot of philosophical weight with them. We could understand how she might have become the kind of person that she did at age 32, given the trauma of the hunting accident initially, and knowing that within the society of Glynnises and Caramés and so forth, that she would always be a sort of odd duck, and she would not dance, and she would not be able to socialize like the other girls. She would protect herself against being hurt by hardening the heart and using her mind instead, and flaunting the lake, stumping around in the house with it. If it could not be concealed, then she would put her identity into it. And there's a link between that accident and the artificial leg and also the kind of studying that she does, which is to study philosophy. The more philosophy Flannery O'Connor's characters study, the less human and the less aware often they are. There's a passage on page 248 that I'll just read because it anticipates what comes at the end of the story. One day, Mrs. Hopewell had picked up one of the books the girl had just put down and opened it at random. She read, "Science, on the other hand, has to assert its soberness and seriousness afresh and declare that it is concerned solely with what is. Nothing? How can it be for science anything but a horror and a phantasm? If science is right, then one thing stands firm. Science wishes to know nothing of nothing. Such is, after all, the strictly scientific approach to nothing. We know it by wishing to know nothing of nothing." These words had been underlined with a blue pencil, and they worked on Mrs. Hopewell like some evil incantation and gibberish. And it is near gibberish also. I wonder whether that was copied out of any book of philosophy or whether it's a parody of twisted philosophical inquiry that Flannery O'Connor has worked up. But later, on page 258, Joy Holga declares, "She was always careful how she committed herself. In a sense," she began, "if you use the word loosely, you might say that." That is, that she loves him. "But it's not a word I use. I don't have illusions. I'm one of those people who see through to nothing, who look at the center of reality and find that it's hollow, in the same way that the Bible has been hollowed out to contain prophylactics and liquor and dirty playing cards and so forth."
That seems really important, the difference between the hollow word and the incarnational word that comes in the manger, in the hay, a person to another, in the flesh word, how that is contrast. I just thought of this, that the Bible is the hollowed out word, and this philosophy ends up being a hollow word, and some of this conversation is just hollowed out word. Incarnational stuff happens in the hay, in the manger, when two people meet, I think.
That sounds very,
all right, just
very spiritual and profound. I'm glad we've got it on tape. I have to publish that sometime.
Just here to record.
The significance of the names. Her name, the name she chose, Hopewell, Freeman, Mamie Pointer, all seem to have significance.
I think we could construct a list of names from Flannery O'Connor in the abstract, outside the context of the stories, and we could do something with any of them. Hopewell, it really does describe her mother. Her mother is a large-hearted woman who thinks the best of everyone and who makes kind of rough distinction between people who have common sense, like the Freeman girls, and those who don't have common sense, like Joy Holga. And although at the beginning of the story, Glynnis and Caramay start out to be foils to Joy Holga, at the end of the story, the kind of knowledge that they have of life with their alternate concern about 32 Fords and church weddings and throwing up and taking prunes for laxatives and so forth, that all makes more sense and is more realistic than where Joy Holga has gone astray. But one of the phrases that I read before did deal specifically with Joy Holga's name. As she sought to turn her dust not into joy, but into ugliness instead. And she, at that point, is a demonic, renunciatory figure also, who will not allow herself to be touched, who hardens herself and exalts her intellect. She has pride in knowing that there is nothing and can imagine no one more superior in it, or superior in understanding to her. Which sets her up for this very ironic fall at the end, when she is confronted with the real face of evil, with the reality of it. She is defenseless because her intellect is not equal to it, cannot deal with it. And so it is that at the end, Mamie Pointer says to her, "I've been believing in nothing ever since I was born. You ain't so smart."
But the grace comes when that all that goes, and Haluka goes with the leg, and she's left with who she is, and that's all right. And that's grace, I suppose, that she's acceptable there, just for who she is, and Manly gets something, but he really doesn't get her.
She is definitely vulnerable at the end. It's saying a wisecracking way that she doesn't have a physical leg to stand on anymore at the end, because even that body part has replaced flesh with something that's material. And she can't support herself at the end. She cannot stand upright without help. That prop has been taken away, and she has fallen down. Any other comments on the story itself? We could read through it for many passages.
I wondered at the line in there about Mrs. Hopewell needing Mrs. Freeman to do what she was too good to do, or something like that. I don't remember the exact line.
Memory and sense.
After the reference from the farmer they worked with before.
Mm-hmm. Well, she's been warned by the previous employer, the Freemans, that Mrs. Freeman is a nonstop talker and a real pain. In a way, she's like Bailey's mother in A Good Man Is Hard to Find, who finally gets shot because she is so talkative. And Flannery O'Connor kind of wishes that end to any woman who is so thoughtless and loquacious, to just put a bullet through her and have an end to it.
He says she needs someone to walk over the fields with her.
And talk to, mm-hmm. Right. Since she had divorced her husband. Mm-hmm. She needs a companion. And both of them need to feel superior to the other. Incidentally, after Good Country People was published, Flannery O'Connor got a letter from a woman in Indiana saying that she knew the original for Manly Pointer, because the son of a widowed minister was selling prophylactics and Bibles in Indiana. And Flannery O'Connor had the good grace not to inquire whether he was selling them to the same people at the same time. But as grotesque as her world is, there are human cruelties too.
The sentence I was thinking about was on 244. Mrs. Hopewell had no bad qualities of her own, but she was able to use other people's in such a constructive way that she never felt the lack.
Uh-huh. As a point of a conclusion or further thought, I'd like to refer you to the part on the handout which refers to the Catholic Worker. It's a short quotation about two-thirds of the way down. Reading, do you see the Catholic Worker? It irritates me considerably because I don't go for the pacifist anarchist business. She's referring here to Dorothy Day, who was one of the featured figures in the movie Excuse Me, America, which we saw Monday. And Dorothy Day at this time had visited Koinonia, which is an anarchist pacifist utopian community in Americus, Georgia, and had been shot at. And Flannery O'Connor was very, very impatient with flaunting one's good works in this way, and have a much divided attitude towards this public utopian experiment which was supposed to show the Christian way to all men. And she said that Dorothy Day's experience in Georgia reminded her of the Tennessee frontiersman who said, "I'm going to go to Texas and fight for my rights." That was very ironic. For her, charity began at home, not tinkering with institutions, not with social revolution, but instead with the individual's relationship to God and doing good in one's own setting through the simplest kinds of charity, charitable acts to others, which she was also very good at. But she had a running battle with the radical Catholic workers movement, with that fringe of Rowan Church. As she wrote in other places, her realities are incarnation, redemption, grace, and original sin also figures very strongly in her work. And the thrust of her stories, one after another, is to strip the individual of illusions and protections which would keep him from seeing the face of God. And out of the confrontation of one with his own sinfulness, to then prepare him perhaps to accept the grace as it comes through the story.